Esperi.
May it please the court. My name is Peter S. Balestrieri. I represent the plaintiffs, appellants, Magdalena and Ryan Smoot.
I'm still unhappy about this jurisdictional issue. So you say the appellee, Tokio Marine Fire Insurance Company, is a foreign corporation organized on the laws of Japan with a U.S. branch capitalized. Principal place of business of the U.S. branch is New York. What's that about? What's a U.S. branch? Is that a corporation or what?
I assume so, Your Honor.
If you assume so, then you've got another corporation in here, another defendant, and of course you haven't alleged where it's to, you know, states of citizenship and corporation. You've said principal place of business. If it's a corporation, you have to give its state of incorporation.
Well, as I understand it, it's a foreign corporation with a license to do business in the United States. We started this in state court. It was removed by the defendants.
But when we ask you in our supplemental order to comply with our rules, is it that difficult?
This is what we found. Went on the Internet, and this is what we found. That they are a business out of New York and from Japan, but licensed to do business in the United States with their principal place of business in New York. That's all we found.
Well, maybe your opponent knows more. So anyway, you can proceed with your argument.
Over 7.5 years ago, Mrs. Smoot was injured when the airbag system in her 97 Mazda inappropriately deployed. Now, we have two main theories of why we believe our expert should be allowed to testify. This is a Daubert motion stated in the Wisconsin Supreme Court case of Poplinski versus Phobes. A res ipsa instruction should be given when either a layman is able to determine as a matter of common knowledge or an expert testifies that the result which occurred does not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence. We believe Judge Stadtmiller, who had this case originally, in his order of February 5, 2004, said that the plaintiff needed an expert because a layman, based on the evidence in the record, could not determine as a matter of common knowledge that airbags should not have ordinarily deployed in the absence of negligence. The judge did cite the Poplinski case. Poplinski case says that even though it can be a res ipsa case, but you have to have in some instances an expert to educate the jury on a technical matter. Obviously, Judge Stadtmiller felt that a layman person sitting on a jury would not be as well informed as to how airbag systems work. So we felt that our expert was more than qualified to state that under the circumstances, a 35 to 40 mile an hour collision with a piece of asphalt on the highway would not be a situation where an airbag would normally deploy. Airbags can save lives, they can maim and even kill.
How do we know whether it's something where the airbags would ordinarily be deployed? Don't we have to figure out both how much deceleration hitting such a pothole produces and at what rate of deceleration is the airbag supposed to deploy?
And that was answered.
We don't know either one of these in this record.
Well, that was answered in the deposition of the expert when he said that at a car going 35 to 40 miles an hour, the most it would have decelerated is two miles per hour, hitting an object, a movable object such as this. And it was described. The object was described.
Pothole is not a movable object.
Pardon me?
Pothole is not a movable object.
No, but the testimony of Mrs. Smoot was that she never hit a pothole. A pothole.
And the question for deceleration, by the way, is not how much the car's speed would have slowed, but what is the rate of deceleration when the car hits the back wall of the pothole? If you have an instantaneous rate of deceleration that's very fast, but maintained for a short period, an airbag, which is supposed to have an absolutely air trigger sensor for deceleration rates, can deploy. So my question remains, do we know in this record either what the rate of deceleration was or what the design spec for the airbag was about when it was supposed to deploy?
Well, according to our expert,
the answer is either yes or no.
Specifically,
do we know these things in this record?
Specifically, you couldn't know that because, as I stated, It was not the pothole, but the piece of asphalt that was struck, and not
well,
a pothole.
You can engage in a filibuster if you wish, but I would really appreciate it if you would answer my question. It has a yes or no answer. Do we know these things in this record?
No, you don't, because you can't reproduce it. That's the only answer I can give you. But I think if this were the case, you'd have people driving around Chicago with airbags popping off routinely, especially in the winter, if you're talking about a pothole. If you're talking about objects in the road, there's tires, mufflers, pieces of asphalt, whatever. I think we all know as common knowledge as drivers of cars that airbags do not commonly deploy in this circumstance. In other words, airbags are only supposed to deploy if the seatbelt restraint system is not sufficient to protect the passenger. Everybody knows that airbags can do damage. They can also save lives.
I hate to say this, but what you think everybody knows may be entirely false. You know, one of the things airbags are supposed to do is react almost instantaneously at the beginning of an accident when the deceleration begins, because if they don't go off extraordinarily fast, it'll be too late. That means they have to be looking, their little sensor is looking for instantaneous rates of deceleration. That's why we need to know both what that rate was and what the design spec is.
Well, if you look at, I think this is instructive, if you read the safety recall notice, it says, what is the problem? The airbag system on your Mazda was designed to provide maximum protection to occupants of the front seats. However, Mazda has determined that on these vehicles, there's an increased risk of airbag deployment in a low-speed crash or minor impact to the undercarriage. Now, if that wasn't something that they were worried about, people hitting potholes and their airbags going off, I don't think they would have recalled these cars. There would have been no reason to. So I think the recall notice speaks volumes about why these cars were recalled, because airbags can do damage to occupants in this circumstance. Now, if you're hitting a bridge abutment or a tree or another vehicle in a head-on collision, obviously your airbag's going to deploy. But in this circumstance, I just can't conceive of why an airbag would go off hitting a loose impediment in the road. Now, to say that we can't replicate the exact circumstances to prove the point, I think doesn't make sense to me. I think that the second point I'd like to make is the restatement of torts third of products liability, section 3, fits the facts of this case rather neatly. And it even gives what I think is an exceptional example of a situation that's very akin to this, where the woman, her seat inexplicably went backwards, her foot hits the accelerator, and as a result of that, she gets in an accident, there's a fire, car is destroyed, and she brings an action under what really is a res ipsa case, and that's what the comment to the restatement states. And I think that's what you have here. You got a res ipsa case where an expert needs to be employed to educate the jury as to how airbags work and how and when they're supposed to deploy. And I think that is what our expert could easily tell a jury with his mechanical engineering experience, that under these circumstances.
Res ipsa loquitur really goes with expert witnesses. Res ipsa loquitur is supposed to be something where it's obvious this sort of thing doesn't happen without negligence. If you have someone who's actually going to testify that this must have happened because of negligence, you're out of res ipsa loquitur. It's just a standard, just litigating a factual question as to what caused the accident.
Well, that's not what Poplinski says. Poplinski case, Wisconsin case, went to the Supreme Court, says that you may need an expert to explain to the jury the mechanics of the particular instrumentality which caused the damage.
Right, and of course that's just conventional proof of negligence, right?
Well, it talks about res ipsa, so I don't know what to tell you, except that's what the rule states. It's a res ipsa case. It's not a common negligence case. It's a res ipsa case. So I'm only repeating what
doesn't matter.
I'm just
want to save the rest of your time, which is rapidly fleeting.
Sure. Okay. Sure. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Ballastieri. Mr. Fertel?
It pleases the court, Jeffrey Fertel on behalf of the appellees, Mazda Motor of America, Inc., and the Tokyo Marine Fire Insurance Company. First, Your Honor, in response to your question about the jurisdictional statement, in terms of Tokyo Marine and Fire Insurance Company, the corporation is indeed a Japanese corporation. It has an office, principal place of business in Japan. It also operates a U.S. branch as part of its umbrella of coverage, and the U.S. branch has headquarters
What is the relevance of the U.S. branch to jurisdiction?
Well, I don't know if it. I don't think it has any relevance as to jurisdiction.
What did you put in your jurisdictional statement?
That is the way the company refers to their various offices, and
so it's not a corporation.
It's not a separate corporation. Okay. Yes, I apologize, Your Honor. It's sort of the corporate lingo, so to speak, that the company goes by. So that's why it was in the statement.
Perhaps in the future when filing jurisdictional statements, you will respond to the jurisdictional rules rather than corporate lingo.
Well,
we didn't ask you to give us the corporate lingo. We asked you to give us the facts relevant to jurisdiction.
Which I think it does in the sense that it says that first of all, the home corporation is in Japan, and that's where it's incorporated under the laws, and that the principal place of business is both in Tokyo, and they also operate a principal place of business in New York, so I think both are relevant.
No.
You have two principal places
of
business.
You can only have one principal place of business.
Now, that's
an office in New York is not a principal place of business. So what is it? It's principal place of business or an office?
It's its U.S. branch, as they've termed it, which is, and its principal place of business is in Tokyo, Japan. Your Honor, in response to the argument so far, the one thing that we have not heard from the appellant in this case, and that is that the standard of review here is whether or not Judge Herndon was correct in excluding the testimony of the plaintiff's expert in this case. And the standard of review here would be that of abuse of discretion. It's clear that Judge Herndon had applied the correct Daubert standards in terms of conducting his analysis, and that he then came to a conclusion using the factors of this court as well as the U.S. Supreme Court.
Why is anybody paying any attention to Daubert? Daubert was replaced 4 years ago by Rule 702.
Right. Your Honor,
which does not just restate Daubert. It actually changes the rule in some respects. So why don't we just worry about Rule 702?
All right. So Rule 702 was relied upon by Judge Herndon in terms of his analysis of this case. And as a result of him applying the proper framework from Rule 702, his analysis is then treated as an abuse of discretion standard. It won't be overruled unless this court's convinced that he committed manifest error in terms of doing that. In conjunction with that, it should be clear that, first of all, what's not on appeal here is Judge Stottmiller's original decision that indicated that the plaintiff could not proceed in this case without having some type of expert testimony to prove up their proof of a defect and cause as it relates to this airbag system. That has not been appealed. The question is whether or not this expert should have been allowed to testify. And I think it's clear that on a number of grounds, this gentleman clearly was not in a basis or in a position to offer testimony in this case. And I think Judge Easterbrook, you hit it right on the head when in your questioning of appellant's counsel here, and that is there is simply no information or opinion in the record which gives us anything about the design specifications for this system.
Isn't that a little puzzling? Why didn't the defendant, which surely knows its own design specifications, put that in the record?
It was never asked of us, Your Honor. It wasn't our burden of proof in this case. The plaintiff decided that
Why is this a disclosure you would make right off the top under Rule 26, which says the party should be disclosing spontaneously without the need for judicial interrogation those things that matter to the case?
Well, you know, Your Honor, we had supplied our at least preliminary technical or offered the operator's manual. We offered the information we had available. We did not produce any design specifications for the system in conjunction with our disclosure. And the plaintiff, E, never asked for it. B, never conducted any discovery. In fact, no discovery was ever taken in the case. And, in fact, the first time that we moved for summary judgment on the case was after discovery had been closed. And after discovery was closed, we moved for summary judgment, and that's when Judge Stottmiller indicated that the evidence was insufficient, but indeed gave the plaintiff another kick at the cat, so to speak, to indeed get an expert, and that's when they indeed brought their expert in, and he was deposed, and the expert did absolutely nothing in terms of anything to prepare himself to offer testimony in this case.
Let me ask you this. If you're correct, and I assume you are, in saying that Judge Stadmiller's original opinion that an expert was necessary here is not properly before us. Can't say it's inferentially before us here because of the Daubert situation, Rule 702, and so on. I'm just wondering, just as a practical matter, why an expert is really necessary in a case of airbag deployment like this.
Sure.
What if this car was parked in the driveway and they turned the ignition on and the airbag activated and the person was injured? Would you need an expert witness to testify about that?
Well, I don't. It would depend upon, I think, Your Honor, as to the circumstances.
The answer is no.
The answer is it could be, Your Honor, because of the fact that...
Well, wouldn't it have to be no? I mean, why would you need an expert
would depend
to say
on the,
that
on the
shouldn't
age,
happen?
It could, would depend on the age and so on of the car. I mean, if you had a car that was...
If you got an old car, the airbag should would reactivate when it's parked?
Your Honor, you'd be surprised at what...
You're not powering them with nitroglycerin that after a period of time just explodes spontaneously.
Your Honor, you'd be surprised at what could potentially activate these systems. If somebody's been in there and monkeying around with the wiring as it relates to stereo systems...
Well, that's different because for res ipsa to apply, you'd have to prove that it was in the same condition as it was when it was manufactured.
Right.
If somebody monkeyed around with it, then res ipsa would not apply.
That's true. But I guess the point of it is that can you categorically say that you wouldn't need an expert under those circumstances? I could foresee that there could be a dispute as to whether or not the wiring was indeed...
The question is, could you certainly have a prima facie case, right?
Under the circumstances.
In Judge Evans's case, the seat bag goes off while the car is parked. That's enough, it seems to me, to get to a jury. And if the defendant wants to show, you know, monkey business, was 120 degrees, something like that, something very strange, anomalous, the airbag had been replaced or something, then that would be their burden of production. That's how you do these things. You don't want to drag experts in unless you think there really is some dispositive issue that you need expert evidence on, which in Judge Evans' hypothetical case, probably don't need an expert.
I mean, I think you're right, Your Honor. If I go and buy a car today and I take it into my driveway and the airbag goes off as I get out to show somebody my car, I would think that I'd be able to, you know, pretty well go in and say, hey, there's something wrong with this thing. But I guess with regard to our case here, the differentiating factor, however, is that we've got a car that's on the road that it's traveling at least 35 to 40 miles per hour, goes into a pothole, and by the report to the police...
Is there a question about whether it hit a pothole or whether it hit something in the road? But anyway, it seems to me what happened here is a lot closer to the airbag deploying in the parking lot than to hitting a tree going 40 miles an hour.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because of the fact that when we're talking about speeds of 35 to 40 miles an hour, a description of this having occurred by the plaintiff saying that they were severely jolted, they're being damaged to the car in terms of there being rim damage, the actual metal rim being bent, you've got the tire having to be replaced, and you had the whole front end having at least suggested to be aligned. that is the type of evidence which now brings this outside of the res ipsa case that we've been talking about, and now requires, I know that expert testimony in terms of what the rate of deceleration is, how this was supposed to go off, and so on and so forth. And in this case, this expert simply didn't do anything. I mean, he did nothing to familiarize himself with this vehicle, with the system in this vehicle, nor did he do anything to analyze the evidence in this case that was available to him in terms of reaching an analysis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fertel. And Mr. Balestrieri, you have about, a minute or so? Yeah.
Your Honor, in Judge Herndon's decision, he says, but Marty has not examined the actual vehicle. This was 3 years later, nothing to examine. Has not reviewed any post-accident photographs.
Nothing to examine? What happened to it?
It was sold. I mean, this was years later.
Photographs being taken?
Photographs were taken, and photographs were viewed by Mr. Marty, our expert. He found there's no damage to the front end of the car at all. All there was a bent rim. Nothing. That's really almost nothing. I mean, when you see cars where airbags have gone off, they're crushed.
Couldn't an engineer figure out from the amount of damage to the rim what the rate of deceleration would have been at the time of the impact?
What he testified to, that because of the damage, as shown by the invoice, it was not appropriate for the airbags to deploy. That's just what he said.
No, that's not my question.
Yeah.
My question is, could an engineer determine from the damage to the rim what the rate of deceleration would have been? You can figure out how much force was required to damage the rim. You can figure out about over how much time that force was applied. Therefore, you can figure out how many joules the car was losing in a period of time, and you could figure out the rate of deceleration.
And his opinion was 35 to 40 miles an hour, airbags could not deploy with the rate. Specifically, to answer your question, no. But as a practical matter, it couldn't happen. It shouldn't happen, I guess is a better way to describe it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Balestrieri and Mr. Fertel.